I want them all. I want all the world. I want them alive if possible, if not wasted. But I want them. Send the word.
Warriors, come out to play. Warriors, come out to play. Warriors, come out to play.
Welcome to Now Playing's bonus movie review of The Warriors. Hosted by Jacob.
He's the one and only.
Stuart.
That's him! That's the warrior!
And Arnie.
So we know about you guys.
How'd you hear about us?
You know how it is. Word gets around.
Well, yeah, I guess we are pretty well known.
This podcast will contain detailed plot spoilers and harsh language.
Come on, Sirens, we're with you! Go ahead, bro!
Listener discretion is advised.
Let's go!
All right, now for all you boppers out there in the big city, all you street people with an ear for the action, I've been asked for lay request for the Gramercy Rifts. It's a review of The Warriors, starring Michael Beck, Deborah Van Valkenburg, James Remar, Dorsey Wright, directed by Walter Hill. This is Arnie, co-host of Now Playing.
Stuart in LA.
And this is the host who's not exactly the State Department type, Jacob.
And welcome to our very first Podbean patron bonus podcast. In the past, we'd kind of done Easter eggs for those who go above and beyond to support us. Now that we've got this a little bit more formalized, you guys get podcasts not available anywhere else. So thank you so much for your support. Especially thank you to those who are pledging $50 and over right now. David Billington, Joseph Black, and Scott Addison, thank you guys so much for your support of our show. It means the world to us. I'm not going to go into it, but you guys are saving Now Playing.
Indeed, and an extra special thank you from me because, hey, I was told by Arnie, I don't think I even understood what we were recording, but he's like, we need a one-off. We need to get this thing rolling. And I'm like, finally, at last, a reason that we can podcast about one of my favorite cult movies, The Warriors.
If we had a dollar for every time you referenced it on a show, we wouldn't need a patron campaign.
Am I a broken record? I don't know. It's just a movie that I know so many people love and just fits in our wheelhouse so well. And yet for some reason, because it's never been a franchise, I suppose, we just never gotten to it. And, you know, I kept waiting for the remake, kept waiting for hearing what it's going to be. It looks like it's going to end up being a TV series anyway. So when it does finally come back, we won't be covering it as such. So this might be the only way and the only time I ever get to talk about it. But yeah, I'm super jazzed.
Yeah, I almost pulled the plug on it. I saw that Neville Dean of Neville Dean Taylor of Ghost Rider and Crank fame was working on the remake, but that thing's been in development hell for many years. So I'm like, okay, I don't think that's actually going to happen.
No, that's dead. As dead as Ghost Rider 2.
He was talking about it just as recently as last year, but what he said last year is there hasn't been a lot of movement since like 2014.
I'll talk about where we're at with remakes, but they don't have it anymore.
Now, this is a movie that I know you love. I've only seen it once. It was in the early 2000s. It was new on DVD, and you came down to visit and brought it with you, and we watched it together. I was excited because there was a new video game coming out, and you're like, oh, the video game's based on a movie, and we even went and I think we rented the video game.
I never played the video game. I did watch a walkthrough, or at least some of it. It's very long, so, you know, I got the gist. But no, I've never played it.
I gotta imagine it's like a Grand Theft Auto type game.
I don't know. I've never played that.
Wow.
Grand Theft Auto came out a little bit later, at least the good ones. But I did play the Warriors game. I do remember that. So it must have been that we watched this and talked about the game coming out, and then I did pick up the game, rented it, and played it a little bit. I found the game not that exciting. As for what I thought of the movie, that's what we're here to discuss.
Yeah, this is one I feel like if you're into pop culture stuff, this gets referenced a lot. I knew a lot of the iconography, some of the greatest lines from it. I only saw it, though, for the first time about a year ago. You know, sometimes, you know, I know Stewart's brought up a lot to do for a show, and sometimes I put movies off because of that, but I figured, we're never going to do this because it isn't a franchise. And it popped up on Netflix streaming about a year ago, I'd say, and I watched it then, and it's one of the few times, at least I could find, that they were showing the theatrical cut. This theatrical cut is very hard to find these days, it seems.
Is it?
It is digital. I ended up watching both cuts just because they pissed me off. All I could find was this new director's cut. It was all that was on Blu-ray, and it's all that's been released on DVD for quite some time. And I'm like, these guys are being problematic. Then I saw iTunes actually just had for rent the original theatrical version. Okay. So I rented the theatrical one on iTunes, then watched the Blu-ray in the home theater for notes and this review.
You're kidding me. They're actually saying that this new version is the one to watch over the original? Heresy.
Yeah, no, it was tough for this review to find the theatrical cut because that's the one I wanted to watch again because I've never seen this ultimate director's cut, but I remember when it was coming out in Blu-ray, I hadn't even seen the movie. I'm like, oh, I'm just going to buy that because that's the director's cut. It's going to have all the cool extra scenes. And the outcry, it was Star Wars Special Edition style outcry. I found forums where people are like, no, we must do our own cut to get this in high def back to the theatrical edition. This is an outrage what they've done to this beloved movie.
You know, it's not that different. I wanted to start off by saying we're talking about the difference between some color correction and an opening scene and whether or not this movie is comic book influenced, all of which I guess I'll talk about when we get into, but it doesn't really do much either way, to be honest. But I definitely prefer the original, if only for nostalgia.
I'll agree. I thought the original worked a little bit better. I have no nostalgia for this film, having not seen it until the 2000s, but the additions, especially that prologue, I just didn't care for so much. I definitely preferred and was glad I got to see the original cut.
Yeah, this was the first time that I even became aware that there was another cut. I have a probably first edition version of the DVD. I have not bothered to try and find other cuts of this movie, but it is also the first time that I went back to the source material. I think I knew, it says in the opening credits, based on the novel by Saul Uhrick, I knew there was a source novel, but did not pick it up, did not read it until just a couple days ago, as well as reading the original script, which is a bit different from what we get from the final film as well. And shocked, totally shocked at how different it was, how Hollywood this movie really is from the version that is on the page.
I read the wiki on it, and that was mainly because I was trying to trace this back to its source. The special edition makes it very clear this is based on an ancient story. And I'm going to look to you to clarify that. I thought it was the Odyssey, but maybe not. But I know the Odyssey very well, and I was trying to figure out, okay, we're going to explain what all this means, but are the Lizzies like the sirens, or what's going on here?
You're going real deep. You thought they went Coen Brothers, Oh Brother, Where Art Thou on this?
Yes, exactly.
Oh, they did. The filmmakers did, but the original source novel has nothing to do with the Odyssey. It was written by someone who had studied ancient Greek literature and someone who had also worked for the welfare department of New York for 5 years in the 1950s. And it was sort of the confluence of both of those influences that brought this 40-year-old Saul Uhrick to write about young people in 1965. The novel came out pretty much to no fanfare a few years after A Clockwork Orange was written, and at a time when gangs were pretty much defined by West Side Story. I mean, I think that if people were consuming popular entertainment, that is what they were thinking about.
Yeah, I was surprised reading how early that book was written, because reading about when this film was released, like, I wasn't born in the 60s. I wasn't alive then. I think about gang violence at theaters. I think of Boys in the Hood. But this film got that kind of gang violence going on when people came to see it. And I didn't think of it as something that early.
Yeah, the movie is something entirely different and could have been closer to the source novel had Saul Urich worked it out with the filmmakers that were originally approaching him. That for the first 10 years, they want to honor what he did on the page, which, again, was not a blockbuster bestseller and not particularly action-packed. It is social realism. It is about real life gangs told by someone who really observed their home life. And I'll point them out as we go through the plot, but there are many things that you will think of as definitive about the Warriors that are not in the novel, including the fact that Cyrus is not killed by a rival gang that frames the Warriors.
Is the gang even the Warriors, or is it something else? Again, I only read a wiki article, but it sounded like the main gang was not called the Warriors, but the book was called the Warriors.
Right. They were all Warriors. Warriors was a term used to categorize anybody that was in a gang in New York City. And the primary characters are called the Coney Island Dominators, and they do have a setup very much like this movie. But they are not on the run. They are not being pursued. It is not a chase story. It is a story about one guy who is exposed to parts of town that he's never seen before, and it changes his perspective so that when he finally gets home the next day and returns to his very dull home life, he has a different attitude about who he is and what he wants to do.
It almost sounds in the vein of like The Outsiders or Rumblefish, where, yeah, a more introspective gang story.
Yeah, it is a drama. It is not in any way an action story, and there is very little gang brawling whatsoever. It is based not on the Odyssey. One of the many things that I believe, because of what the filmmakers put in here, like you said, there are sirens, there are the baseball furies, there are allusions to ancient Greece. I assumed that all was playing into the Odyssey, but in fact, what the author was trying to play into was a different conflict that happened, you know, 1,000 years later. I'm not that familiar with the battle between Greece and Persians other than 300, I'm embarrassed to say.
This is 300 before 300?
It happened about, I would say 100 years after the events of the Battle of Thermopylae, which are characterized in 300. There was this story about these ancient Greeks that were trapped behind enemy lines and had to fight their way to the sea. And that was sort of what they were riffing on. And it was a story within the story. There is a gang member that is carrying a comic book, which is something I forgot, but back in the day, comics sometimes would illustrate classic works as a way of getting young men to read things that they never would ordinarily, you know, classics illustrated kind of thing.
Sadly, it's the only way I've ever read Treasure Island.
Exactly, yeah. There's a lot of things that I only know through, their pictorial versions. But basically, it was used in contrast to what these men were doing and looking at valor and family and honor as it was perceived in ancient times through this comic book one guy's reading while they're, going about their day and trying to make it to this big gang meeting. But that's not the movie Hollywood would want to make. When it got purchased, it was given to Walter Hill, who was still a relatively young director. Many of the famous movies that he would make, he has not made yet. 48 Hours is still about 3 years away. But he was having a nice track record. He had done a boxing movie with Charles Bronson called Hard Times that was well received. And he had done a really cool Ryan O'Neill kind of European car chase movie called The Driver that I kind of like. And it wasn't a big hit, but he was seen as an action director on the rise. And when the material wound up in his lap, he saw it exclusively. In fact, told the author, don't get too attached to your version because I'm going to do something very, very different.
I had to look him up and I know him as an action producer. I'm sure we're going to talk about it. I have some issues with the action in this film and I wondered what this guy went on to do. And yeah, the 48 Hours films and Red Heat. So I guess he got better.
He got better? With Red Heat?
Red Heat, yeah.
All right, I'm already ready to pull out the knife here. I think I know where you're going with this.
As far as staging action fights go on screen, he got better.
Okay. And yeah, and that's one of the things I love about this movie is it's an action movie that isn't about fight choreography. So often it's about like fast cutting and who's got the cool style. And I know when they remake this, they'll really be very specific about each gang having their own little martial arts whatever. And that's not what I love about this movie. What I love about this movie is the camaraderie and the feeling of a city at night. And certainly the way that they film this and walk us through a city. Always a favorite theme of mine is when they can show us and really show off a location. I really think that this is one of the great New York movies.
Yeah, I definitely love the feel of people listened to our John Wick review very recently. I kind of went off on how much I love the subway systems.
I was thinking about John Wick during this because I'm like, man, the subway system's really changed.
It has quite a bit, even the maps. And so I did enjoy this travelogue back to New York when it was a bit more dangerous, but also had a bit more character.
Yeah, I romanticize. I said this when we covered Maniac, that 80s slasher movie. I have sort of an affection. Not that I would want to live there, and certainly not that I would want to see New York return to it, but yeah, pre-Giuliani New York is just something that I love to see on film. It feels like hell on earth. And, you know, as someone that loves horror movies and dark visions, I just always like seeing it depicted on screen.
Having only been to New York pre-Giuliani, that's still how I think of the city. Like, yeah, there is some glamorization to it, but it was scary as hell when I went there as a kid. Like, I got stories, gang fights on subways, getting lost in Harlem. It was scary.
And they had trouble shooting this. You know, they didn't use sets. By and large, they shot on location in the places where these characters were supposed to be, by and large. And yeah, New York crowds are not in love with Hollywood. Sometimes they would have to pay off real gangs in order to get the shot done, and things would get stolen. And yeah, they really hired a gang leader to play Cyrus here, and then somebody put a hit on him and he didn't show up for work and they had to get somebody else. They had a lot of trouble getting this to the screen, and Walter Hill came in really, really late. He was actually trying to get a Western made. It fell through, and 2 months later he was making this. So he didn't have a whole lot of time to plan and set things up. This is very much an improvised by instinct kind of filmmaking and has a lot of scars because of that. They lost a lead actor mid-shooting during this, and lots of things got changed.
Was it Ramar?
No, it's a fox. You may not even notice him, but he's the one that gets killed.
Oh, okay.
That's why they killed him.
Yes.
I wondered why James Ramar was given like third billing and disappears 2/3 of the way through the film, never to be seen again. But we'll talk about it.
Yeah, well, you know, that character is not the star of the movie. The one that was intended to be the star of the movie got switched about halfway through filming. And then the editors had new ideas and they went back to refilm. But there was a lot of pressure to get this movie out quick. Because, believe it or not, they were worried about other gang flicks. There was a movie called The Wanderers, which was about a 60s greaser gang. I've never seen it. I've heard it's very good, but it was coming out, and they wanted to beat it. And, of course, there was Grease. They were worried about Grease.
That gang movie, of course.
I did think about Grease, though. I mean, some of the gangs here are very pink ladies.
Yeah. So, you know, they rushed this out to a February release, something we usually mock here. But it was successful. Critics didn't like it by and large, but people turned out and it made a tidy sum in theaters and, yeah, has gone on to have an even wider audience in home viewing.
Well, then why don't you walk us through it? Stuart, let's give us the plot and let's find out what The Warriors is all about.
Can you count, suckers? Because street gangs outnumber cops by a 3-to-1 margin in this funhouse mirror version of New York City, if you can count. In fact, the only reason that juvenile delinquents haven't brought the Big Apple to its knees is because gang members are stuck in a tribal mentality that has them fixated on defending their individual little turf. It takes a messianic figure like Cyrus, head of a highly influential gang called the Riffs of Gramercy Park, to recognize New York as a potential gangster's paradise. The movie begins with Cyrus inviting 900 gang delegates from 100 different neighborhoods to the Bronx for a citywide peace summit. Most attendees have complied with the no weapons ordinance and are receptive to Cyrus's message that it's all our turf if petty territorial disputes are set aside. But the moving speech is squelched by a rogue act of violence committed by Luther, leader of the appropriately named gang, the Rogues, and played by iconic movie villain David Patrick Kelly. Luther produces a pistol and shoots Cyrus dead in mid-speech, then blames the assassination on the Warriors, a rival gang from Coney Island. Warlord Cleon is unable to dispute the charge before he's overpowered, but his eight fellow warriors slip away amid the chaos of an ensuing police raid. The Gramercy Riffs replace fallen leader Cyrus with Masai, a humorless sensei in sunglasses and a very sparkly robe, who initiates a citywide manhunt for the fleeing warriors. Aided in his quest is a snarling radio DJ, who ladles her on-air patter with coded threats and instructions on where listeners can find the warriors' next location. Newly elevated War Chief Swan, played by Michael Beck, tries to keep his seven brothers safe as they make their way home, chased out of the Bronx by a pack of skinheads, then taunted by a trampy groupie named Mercy, who baits them into a fight with the wimpy but nonetheless armed outfit, the Orphans. Fox, the only warrior to actually see Luther pull the trigger on Cyrus, is killed when the group reaches the 96th Street subway station and cops push him in front of a speeding train. The warriors scatter, each fragment spending the next few hours experiencing various forms of female trouble. Rowdy Ajax, played by James Remar, holds up well against a gang of bat-wielding baseball fanatics in Central Park, but proves no match for a buxom undercover cop who entraps the rapist in an after-hours sting. Three other warriors, Cochise, Vermin, and Rembrandt, almost get their throats slit when they're taken in by a gang of seductresses known as the Lizzies, and that's when they learn that they've been framed for the shooting of Cyrus. Meanwhile, Swan gets lost in the dank subway tunnels with Mercy, whom he loves to lecture about her perceived low morals, yet still falls for her tough chick charm. Swan and Mercy eventually reconnect with four warriors at Union Station, where they fight a gang of roller skating punks in the men's room before hopping the morning train to Coney. And while all of this is going on, Luther, his right-hand man Cropsey, and all the guilty members of the Rogues are sweating the fact that an eyewitness to their crime has evaded capture. So they pile into a graffitied hearse and drive down to Coney Island to finish the job before the Gramercy Riffs find out who really shot Cyrus. And that's when, in arguably the movie's most famous sequence, Luther slips bottles onto his fingers and clanks out a tribal beat, baiting Swan and the others to come out and play on the neighboring beach. There, Luther confesses to killing Cyrus before Swan knocks the gun out of his hand with a switchblade. Masai and the other Gramercy Riffs arrive, having gotten word of the warriors' innocence. They concede that the warriors are good, real good, before getting all medieval on the asses of the Rogues. Swan takes Mercy for a romantic stroll down the beach as both contemplate life beyond their little patch of turf, and the DJ apologizes to the warriors with an Eagles tune as credits roll. And so about the only difference here that we have, that I can tell, between this new, what, ultimate cut? Is that what they're calling it? The BS yes. cut, the comic book cut.
They call it the director's cut, but then it's the ultimate edition Blu-ray that comes with like an hour documentary and things.
Okay, yeah, it had some bonus features, but I was looking forward to seeing the original opening. I always knew that they did a better job than what was done in the first movie of explaining who the warriors were and what each person on the mission was supposed to do. And it was done in daylight on the boardwalk. They go marching off. I always knew about it, but it's not even here. This ultimate version still opts for the very same opening. They just put before that some comic book prologue about ancient Greece and the Battle of Cunaxa.
So you're saying that there are cut scenes?
No, there is cut scenes that are not on this ultimate cut Blu-ray even that I have seen. You can actually YouTube them. They're out there. But they show the original idea for how to tell this story. The original idea was that we meet a girlfriend, Lincoln. So named, I imagine, because of the ties to assassination. But Lincoln comes to talk to Cleon, the leader of the warriors, and tell him she thinks it's a bad idea for them to go to the big meeting that night. And we see all of the individual guys doing their thing. And Swan is playing with that switchblade that he'll end up using in the next morning. And We get a whole lot more of Fox, who again was originally the lead of the whole movie.
That may have been useful because I have a hard time besides Swan and Cleon and Ajax and Rembrandt. I can name about half of the warriors. The other half, I could write down characteristics. There's a dude dressed as an Indian, and I guess that was normal in New York. I've seen Can't Stop the Music. That's one of the village people did that. But you know what? I really dig this opening. I don't know. There's something about just starting in the middle.
Sure.
The way it's cut, that with, you know, going back and forth between the warriors and then just cutting to the other gangs and the subway and this opening theme with the, you know, the synth and the electric guitar instantly gets me into this movie when I watch it.
I agree completely. The way it throws you in and it tells you everything you need to know in these little interludes. You know, it says why they're going, that there's this guy, Cyrus. He's the one, so I guess he's Neo.
No, I saw him as like Martin Luther King or any cult of personality figure that, you know, he's got a dream, right? He's going to bring them all together. And like every leader of that type from the 1960s, they end up getting shot.
Very true. And I like the way all the different gangs are introduced. So many of them we will never see really again, except in the background of some scenes. But yeah, I definitely was thinking Grease when I see the guys in all the yellow jackets. They don't look so much like street gangs as they look like dance troops.
Yeah, you got the pimps, you got mimes, you got guys in camo outfits. You got some crazy gang colors going on here.
My absolute favorite are the Buddhist monks. I think they might be the Mongols or the Huns. I don't know. I have a list of every gang that is in there. And there was a costume designer that was assigned and drew outfits for every of the 100 gangs that are going to be represented. You say Grease. For me, I feel like the template must have been Clockwork Orange, right? The droogs that sort of like mod fashion choices. It feels futuristic. And indeed, one of the things that the Ultimate Cut gets right is that they have a little comic book title card that says, sometimes in the future. This is not 1979 as we know it. This is some alternative reality where, yeah, gangs dress like this.
I know you're a big fan of Kubrick. We reviewed A Clockwork Orange for Kickstarter, but because of the comic book panels and everything, my mind went to a different source of inspiration. That's Batman 66, with the way all the various villains would have their costumed henchmen that would always have the similar outfits and everything. So I saw these very much as like comic book gangs.
Yeah, but that's because of the Ultimate Cut. I mean, that was one of the things that made me mad about the Ultimate Cut is I never saw the Warriors as a comic book. To me, comic book means superhero, and that sets a wrong tone for this.
Yeah, but there is some camp with all these costumes. Again, you have a gang of mimes going on. It almost feels like they got some like 60-year-old Hollywood writer, hey, do something about modern gangs, and they don't know anything, and they come up with these ideas. But there's also a grit to this film, like, as funny as some of these costumes are, there's some real like rough language and things said about women in this film. Like there is a grit here despite these colorful costumes.
And Saul Urich did have that big complaint. You know, he was not invited on set. He wrote the novel and it was like, thank you very much. Go away. We're going to do our own thing with it. But when he met with Walter Hill, he's like, oh yeah, this guy doesn't know how kids talk. I spent 10 years talking to kids. I know how they speak and I know how gangs work. And I know that they, one, are not ethnically integrated. The idea that there is going to be white, Latino, and black all in the same gang is absolutely ridiculous. And Hill, I think, wanted to have the gang be all black, and the Hollywood suits told him absolutely not.
Yeah, it feels that way because they have Cleon, who's the original leader, and then they're going to end up with Michael Beck from Xanadu as the leader.
Well, he hadn't done Xanadu yet. He got Xanadu out of this movie.
Yeah, it was coming out the next year, yeah.
But what happened is exactly that, that they wanted some real leading man types to come in here and someone to reach demographics that don't normally see movies about gangs. People that want to see John Travolta sing in a gang are what they're trying to reach here with some of these compromises. And that's what really created the campy look. Hill was like, if I can't have realistic gangs, then I guess I have to go the other way with it. I guess I have to dress them in a lavish, never-before-seen way and just go with that.
But that is so much of the charm of this film, I feel.
It is. I think that since he couldn't get actual gang violence down, the fact that he did make it all of this surreal type of gang is what makes this very memorable.
No, agreed. And again, as the fan, as much as I can recognize that this is Hollywood sellout, and here's a case where that's a good thing. There might be a terrific movie in Saul Urich's book that did not get made, but I would not want it to exist at the sacrifice of this vision, which, again, comes out almost as an happy accident that we're getting what we're getting. One other rumor I had always heard all my life about this movie that got debunked when I did my research was that I heard they wanted to do like a Blade Runner future and that they just ran out of money. And so they were left with these outlandish costumes and then like a real New York to have as the backdrop. But no, they knew when they were filming this that this was just going to be, I call it an alternative world. This is not the future. This is not science fiction. This is some funhouse version of what New York in 1978, 1979 would be.
Without Giuliani, this could actually be what New York would look like.
If only. I mean, I would prefer it much more than what's going on at Times Square at this point.
But we get right into the action. One thing about this movie, one of the reasons why I watched it twice, even though I'm not the fan, it's short. It's a 90-minute movie. I'm able to watch it twice in the time it takes, or less than the time it takes to watch some of the other movies we do. So it's going to get us to this gang meetup right there, and we are going to get to see Cyrus giving his speech. And he asks, can you count? And I'm asking, can he multiply? Because I don't get his math.
He's rounding. He's, yeah, there's 9 members, 100 gangs, and there's 100 other gangs. That's 20,000. It's 18,000. He's just rounding up. I don't care. I want to join Cyrus. Like, this actor, I don't know if these are the lines he was given, if he improvised, but this is a charismatic dude. I am ready to join him. I am down, sucka.
I agree. He's a lot of fun. I had problems with the math, too, at first. I'm like, sucka, you can't count. But what he actually said was, there's 20,000 hardcore members, 20,000 more affiliates, that's 40, and then 20,000 that aren't organized but are ready to fight. So it's 60,000 of these juvenile delinquents against 20,000 police. The math does add up.
I guess I'm just not sure where he gets 20,000, because he says, you're standing right now with 9 delegates from 100 gangs.
These are the delegates.
Right.
There's 100 gangs, so obviously they end up having hundreds in their rank.
And there's 100 more gangs that aren't even at this meeting.
Yeah, because you're seeing 9 people from the Warriors is not to say you're seeing all of the Warriors. They actually are 120 strong.
Yeah, I got that. I was curious how he got the number 20,000, and then that every number is 20,000. But you know what? I can dig it. I'm going to go with it. I just was curious where that number was coming from. It does look like quite a mob when they're all surrounding him on all sides, and he's up there speaking, and they're cheering. Not to be too base about it, but there was no CGI, so they had tons of people here. It was like a concert, it seems like, to have all of these extras and costumes and everything in the right place. It's an amazing scene. He gives an amazing speech. I do think he's a little naive because he talks about how, yeah, like you said in the plot summary, they're fighting over their turf. The man is keeping them fighting against each other so they don't take over. But in addition to turf, there's going to be basically power. I don't know that any of the warlords that are there, the leaders of the gangs, are going to want to suddenly become war chiefs in the big gang that controls all of New York.
They're going to control all of New York. I think he's got a good plan. He's got the math. He's got the numbers. Yeah, rule all of New York.
It's a question of, would you rather serve in heaven or rule in hell? You know, there are some people who would just never want to serve.
One thing he mentions is that once they control all the streets, once they become one gang and not hundreds, then they can actually tax the mafia. I really love that little aside that he was like, the real criminal syndicates will be bowing to them. Not only will the average people, you know, he doesn't really even cop to that because it's New York, right? Everyone's crooked there. But what he's worried about are the mobsters, the Italian Godfather, which was still a very popular movie at this time. That's what he would be fighting by unifying all of the gangs here. It's very, very charming. This actor was a last minute replacement for someone that didn't show up. He really, I think, just played it big, and that was the way to play it for this movie. It doesn't work for Saul Urich's book, which Saul Urich was a socialist, and his speech was actually very passionate and specific, and a whole chapter about what they were going to do, and it ended in a very different way. The cops come in, and the gangs believe that Ishmael, they don't call him Cyrus in the book, but Ishmael sold them out, and they all pull out guns and gun him down. There's no one person that shoots him. They feel like they were set up to get locked up by someone that was trying to, you know, trick them. And so they basically, I think what you're saying, Arnie, that the warlords concede that cynically, no one person can rule all. And so you must just not trust whoever the leader is.
Yeah, I think the biggest leap of faith here is that none of these gangs brought weapons. They were told not to. None of them did, except the rogues, who comically, like, pass. You're going to do a secret assassination. You're going to comically pass this gun, like, down the line, like someone buying a beer and a hot dog at a baseball game.
Or, like, it's in a prison where you're passing it under the table or something.
Yeah, David Patrick Kelly, his first movie and his first shot here is following that gun and then panning up to his rat face as he's, I love the guy. He's a great character actor, but he does just have the face of a villain, always.
Was the dude on coke for this movie? He is so erratic in this film. I don't know if this is just his acting choice, if he was on drugs during this film. He looks pale and clammy throughout. Like, he doesn't look healthy.
They found him in a Broadway musical, believe it or not, or off-Broadway, wow. I should say. It wasn't playing on 42nd Street.
He wasn't doing Grease?
No, he was not doing Grease. It was some kind of hippie thing, and both he and the woman that plays the DJ were in the same show, and they just liked the energy that he brought, so I guess it's a musical theater energy, but they said, do that for this, and this guy had not been in front of the camera before, so I think he just didn't know not to go too big, and again, more is better when you're talking about the Warriors. The more you can pile it on, the bigger and grander you can go. The more melodrama, I think the more you get out of scenes like Cyrus screaming, "Can you dig it?"
I don't know David Patrick Kelly all that well. I looked up his filmography and saw he's been a villain in a lot of movies I've seen a long time ago. I can't remember the last time I saw 48 Hours, for example.
Snake Man in Dreamscape.
A long time ago on that one. And so because we're doing the Twin Peaks retrospective over at nowpeakingpodcast.com, all I could see was Jerry Horn and his brie sandwich, and it just undermined any menace.
What? Nothing could undermine. This is the one cast member of Twin Peaks that did something bigger than Twin Peaks. I will never think of David Patrick Kelly as anything other than Luther, and that's just because, yeah, it's the voice, really. I mean, yeah, the strung out performance is one thing, but that really just every vocal inflection is like a whine, like a Bobcat Goldthwait kind of.
Yeah, very nasally. Yeah.
I mean, it's like a crying baby or something. It's not tough. They're a gang that would get their ass. They need to bring a gun because they would lose in a fist fight. I wouldn't call them scary, but you really want to see them go down. They are easily, instantaneously, whether you like Cyrus's mission or not, whether you would have followed him into that criminal utopia, you want these guys punished hard.
And as Luther shoots Cyrus, the cops have rolled in. We saw them silently rolling in, and now they've turned on the spotlights. Cleon, the head of the Warriors, he gets blamed for it. I thought he just got beat up, that we'd see him later. He's gone for the movie. I don't know if he got killed here, if he's arrested.
It's not clear. I would presume he's dead, because if you said that's the guy that killed your leader, I mean, he was able to beat down a couple rogues, the ones that accuse him, but when the Rifts come in, I mean, they got the martial arts. They don't need guns. They're wearing their...
They all have their karate gis on.
Yeah, their orange karate gis. At first, given who these gangs are, I literally thought they were the bathrobe gang, but then I realized they're doing karate.
Yeah, they are the biggest gang, we're told, in all of New York. That is why Cyrus has had the fortitude to see how much of New York there is and how much more they could get by unifying the gangs. At least that's the way I take it. But in their spare time, they don't need weapons because their fists are weapons. And I think they actually kill the warlord at this point. Cleon is dead. Now it's for the rest of the gang to figure out how to get home. And one of them has actually seen the crime take place. The reason why the Warriors are accused is because Luther knows that Fox was the one that saw everything. And again, in that cutscene, you would learn that he was the scout. He was the one that was supposed to get the closest to size up all the gangs to really know what was going on. Thomas Waits, believe it or not, he was the one actor on this that was Juilliard trained. He was a very experienced actor, and that's why he was cast in the lead. He's very scrawny here. He looks like he wouldn't do well in The Warriors, but what we're supposed to think about him is that he's cunning, he's intelligent, he sees things, and he's really supposed to be our cynical hero that will doubt all of the gangs, gang life in general. All the things that they're going to give Swan to do with the girl lead later, that was for him to do. As it is, I feel like you barely pay attention to Fox. You see him see the crime, and then he runs away.
Yeah, I have him in my notes as Afro Guy, and I didn't catch a lot of these names, even on two watchings. On the second one, I got a few more, Cleon, and finalizing who Ajax was, and Rembrandt. But yeah, some of these others, I was just marking them down by the accoutrement they wore.
Yeah, I'm not thinking about Fox because the struggle of who's going to take over as warlord for the Warriors is Swan and Ajax. Ajax wants it.
Yeah. You know, Swan can say he's the leader because, yeah, that's what Cleon wants.
He probably looks best in a shirtless vest. He's got the muscle. He's got the build.
He's definitely modeling throughout this whole movie. I feel like he's posing. They did get this actor from a science fiction movie made in Israel. They were actually looking at Sigourney Weaver. They were thinking about bringing her into this movie.
Wow.
And Walter Hill was also casting the little science fiction movie he was producing at the same time and said, you know what? She might be better for Alien. So we'll let her do that movie. And her co-star, the one that's here cast as Swan, Michael Beck, was brought in for this instead. They're like, we like what this guy does. And what they kept finding in rehearsal and in dailies, and as the director started hating more and more this Juilliard-trained Thomas Waits, why don't we give it to this guy that's not presumptuous and is not trying to take over our film, and basically just made him, through the shooting of the film, the lead.
Ouch. That's very strange. I couldn't even imagine this movie with Fox as the lead. He is such a minor character.
Believe it or not, what they were trying to set up in the opening was that Swan was a loner, that he didn't like hanging out with anyone, and he actually would have his own subplot. He gets separated from all the gangs and gets kidnapped by the homosexual gang. The dingoes kind of grab him and tie him up and threaten to do terrible things to him, and he has to fight his way out of the gay gang and back to home. So he had his own subplot and everything, and they just ended up changing that and killing Fox. And we get all these rules and dynamics established in the graveyard. What's kind of interesting about this is even though Fox has seen the crime, he doesn't know that it's been pinned on them. That the Warriors just think that the peace truce might be over, and so they might have to battle a few gangs to get home because they're in enemy territory. That they don't know the truth, which is that the Griffs are putting the hit out.
And I didn't catch that. I figured because Fox saw it, I thought they all knew. So about an hour in, when they all seem shocked by it, I'm like, oh, well, I didn't realize you didn't know why you were running.
Yeah, it's all done in dialogue.
Yeah, it's not until they meet the Lizzies they find out what's going on. Because they're still having Rembrandt put their tag up on tombstones. They still got time to spray paint that W on there.
Yeah, that's the point, is wherever they go, they want to let people know that they're there and they don't take off their vests. They don't hide who they are. Wherever they go, this is who they are. And what's kind of interesting to me when I think about it, and I've met people like this really everywhere I've lived, but here in LA specifically, there are some people that have lived in a major metropolitan all their life and never leave their own neighborhood. That the fact that they have only been to Coney Island, this is the first time they've ever gotten onto a train and gone to Manhattan and then gone into the Bronx. God help them trying to figure out a way home. Even if there weren't gangs trying to kill them, I'm not sure how they'd do it.
They think it's 100 miles, so that is right there. They are so screwed.
Which is wrong. That guy can't count. It's actually 30. But yeah, Vermin, not too smart.
Yeah, but those maps are really confusing looking. I had trouble reading them too.
Yeah, I watched the theatrical trailer and it said something like 27 miles or something. So the trailer got it right, but this warrior got it wrong.
Yeah, and there are cut lines and cut little moments where they get clarified. Again, there are a lot of things where the Fox steps in and has the answer. And he corrected that guy and said, no, it's only 27.8. And Fox is, again, in the script, he was really set up to be the smartest one and the most cynical about what was going on.
As the hit is put out, so to say, on the Warriors by the Riffs, they want him alive if possible, but if not, dead. After that opening scene, that montage and the music, I think my second favorite thing in this film is this DJ just doing these coded messages. I love it so much.
Yeah, it's my favorite thing about this. I mean, what a stroke of genius to have the Greek chorus be a radio DJ and we only see her mouth. I've seen still photographs of on the set. She's actually dressed up in suit and tie. She's kind of got an androgynous look to her, and they were going to go that way with her. And then I think it was between the cameraman and the director, they just realized she has this great overbite and we're going to play with that.
Yeah, she has very sexy lips and a really good voice, and I could see her actually being a DJ. You said that they found her in musical theater. She has this wonderful tonal quality to her voice that I think is perfect for this. Yeah.
She reminds me in vocal tones of Angela Davis, if you know her. She would have been very popular that time as an outspoken Black consciousness figure. You know, she was actually nearly arrested and persecuted by the government and I can see what they were doing. They were playing off the Black Panther movement and the figures of the 60s in casting a lot of these iconography. But yeah, I absolutely love her. It's your second favorite thing? I'm going to say it's my favorite thing about this movie.
Yeah, I love the opening of this film so much, but the fact that she does this threat over the radio and then Nowhere to Run comes on, like...
Here's the hit, baby boppers.
Yeah, sometimes I ding a movie for putting music too on the nose, but it's perfect for this film.
Yeah, if you have a DJ who's trying to score the evening, it actually makes a lot of sense versus if you just have somebody in a mixing booth trying to put music that's not actually playing in the movie.
And this is just a great concept. This is something I love. I feel like this is what Suicide Squad was trying to do. Get a small number of anti-heroes that you like and then put them against an entire city that wants to kill them. How thrilling that is. And to do it all at night in this way. Yeah, it's a premise that I could play to me again and again and again. I feel like Escape from New York is this movie. I feel like Trespass and Judgment Night is this movie. So many movies have tried to be the Warriors and do this, not nearly as successful as this movie. But I just, as a concept, just the notion of what these guys are facing in their night to try and get home, just something that I love.
Yeah, I'm going to love the concept because as far as the Warriors go, I don't think I ever really care about any of the characters. Swan, he's so bland. And none of them, I don't feel like they develop any of them to have like these rich backstories where I'm like, oh, I'm really feeling for you. But it's this concept I love. They're just going to have to face every gang in New York to get home.
Yeah, it's about being tough. And to a degree, they do come off more like the Sweat Hogs than anything. They seem a little bit too good, but yet slightly tougher than the T-Birds. But I wish I could get more behind them. And I think some of the ones whose names I don't even know, like Fox and Vermin, seem like the ones that aren't going to be quite so stoic. You know, they have a little bit more emotion in their voice and in their face. But the one I'm focused on is Ajax. And it's because it is James Remar. And he's trying to take control. He wants to be war chief. And so I wonder if that's actually going to lead to some great internal drama. And I'm a little disappointed that it doesn't outside of this graveyard where he tries to do it. He just becomes a little bit of a jerk and accuses them all of going faggot. I thought, wow, that was something you would not put in a movie today.
That's what I'm saying. There's some gritty language in this that has not aged well.
Tarantino would put that in a movie today, no problem. And I do feel like this is a Tarantino recommended movie through and through.
True, he would.
It's un-PC, it is in your face, and even at the time, I think that this would have been language that would have been shocking. It is an R-rated movie, mostly for the language. There isn't a whole lot of blood. The violence that comes is very stylized, and so I feel like what gets the R is this very gruff, coarse language.
Yeah, and we'll see with the first interaction with another gang. They see the train. They're going to try to get on there. But the Turnbull ACs, a skinhead gang.
But multi-ethnic.
With black people on the truck, though.
Yeah. They got black and white skinheads.
Well, there are different kinds of skinheads. They're not all Nazi skinheads. There's a rich tradition of black skinheads.
Driving in a school bus. They need to replace the motor because it apparently can be outrun by men on the street.
Yeah, I'm like, I did laugh at that.
Either the Warriors are really, really fast, like get them to the Olympics, or like that car needs to go away.
Well, if it's a school bus, I remember riding it, and those things do not accelerate for crap. So
that's true. True enough. But it sets up the whole idea that everywhere they go, at every station, there's going to be a battle. And this first level gang is, there's a lot of them, and they're skinheads. And they got planks, but yeah, there's a train waiting. And so it's really just a chase about who can get to the train. And boy, I've done this too, where you're just running to try and get the train. When I lived in Chicago, man, that was the game, man. And boy, you did mock the people that didn't make it there. You'd be like, ha ha, I didn't even know them. And I'd be like, yeah, you didn't get on.
I'll ask the question for those that are unfamiliar with New York, because again, it's been a long time since I was there. So they have above ground trains and the subways. Is that right? And you switch between the two? Because the first train they get on is above ground. They're not in the subways.
In the other boroughs, it's very much above ground. In Manhattan, it's mostly below ground, but there is still the PATH train, so there is one that's above
ground. No, well, it's the same train. We're saying that there's times when that train will come out of a tunnel, yes, and go up on an elevated track.
Okay, so they will go underground as well.
It is the very same line. It is not that you have to change to an above ground from a below ground. And again, these are the kinds of fun things you discover when you try to figure out that subway system, which is, yeah, perhaps the most confusing on Earth. But I love that. I love the fact that these guys that don't know New York but are from New York are trying to figure out the trains and, yeah, get stopped because the tracks are on fire.
Yeah, the Turnbull ACs, they do something smart. They start a fire to stop it.
Do we know it was them? I don't know that we ever find out exactly who did it.
I think they say something like, they set a fire, so I assumed it was the Turnbull.
Yeah, I just heard them say they need to be worried about who set the fire, and I thought we'd find out there's somebody waiting for them, but who's waiting for them are the orphans, who are completely unprepared and would not be capable of setting a fire.
I love this concept. This is one of those, those lesser gangs that Cyrus was referring to. They did not get the invite.
That's what's so painful about it is that, like, they're like, well, if there was a big meeting, they would have invited the orphans. I'm like, no, actually, you're this. And Fox is trying to play it up. He's like, yeah, you guys are so cool that maybe they just didn't even think about it. I'm like, yeah, you're only digging the hole deeper.
Yeah, well, I think there's only less than nine of the Warriors at this point, and there's a lot of orphans, so they're kind of puffing up their ego so they don't attack them.
Yeah, I was doing the math, and it was like, and then there were eight, and then there were seven kind of thing. It actually stops at seven, but I thought it might just end up being Swan alone on the run, and the rest would be, you know, like a horror film. You just kind of kill them off.
Yeah, and it was, I mean, again, in the original conception, Swan was having his own adventure, and they mixed up some other gangs. The other thing that happens, and I'll point it out as we go through, is there is more elimination. There are more characters that died in the original conception, and they just realized, Hill just decided halfway through, in some cases, I like this guy too much. I don't want to see his throat get slashed. So they made the choice not to kill off anymore after they take out Fox.
Was it a choice by the director to make the female love interest the most unlikable person in the world? Mercy, she comes out and the orphans are cool with the Warriors. They're going to let them go by on their turf, and she totally antagonizes them and is like, no, you guys are a bunch of pussies. You got to fight them.
This is straight out of the book, only the difference is you might gasp when you hear the line, maybe we should run a train on you.
Yes, I did.
They actually do in the book. This was actually a Hollywoodization that they don't rape her repeatedly.
I was going to say this film is kind of misogynistic, but I guess it could have been worse according to the book.
Wow.
Again, Saul Urich's intention was to not back away from any hard truths, and he saw this as something that was done. I shouldn't say rape because I think it was consensual, but it was, yeah, it was.
Is the term you're looking for gangbang?
Yes, it was an aggressive gangbang that she may or may not have completely consented to. And it's a pretty shocking on the page. And here it's just made an allusion to that. It's something that this gang might have done at a different time, but they're not going to do it to her. And she will stay in the story. That is a Hollywood conceit as well.
So she was introduced to have a train ran on her and then she disappeared from the book?
Correct.
Wow.
I don't understand her character here, because she does come out. First of all, the actress reminds me a little bit of a young Laura Sanjiacomo with the attitude and the way she talks.
I was getting Michelle Rodriguez myself from those Fast and Furious movies. And she has a familiar face. She was on Too Close for Comfort afterwards. She got a gig from this and was a reoccurring character on a sitcom.
We've talked about her before with Firestarter 2 Rekindled.
Yeah, barely talked about her. Also worth pointing out, another sitcom star almost was the lead in this movie, Tony Danza. Instead of Michael Beck, geez, we could be talking about him.
I think Michael Beck's the better choice.
You know what? I've seen Taxi, and Tony Danza was really good on Taxi. I think Danza might have been able to pull it off back then.
Did he have those pecs, though?
Yeah, he did. But as far as Mercy goes here, yeah, she does come out and just causes the gang to almost get killed by the orphans, but then she's going to follow them, and I don't understand her arc. The way she admits to being a very, I don't want to slut shame her, but she sleeps with a lot of people, and Swan says you might as well have a mattress on your back, but then later on, is he into that? I don't understand this relationship.
Yeah, no, I don't get her arc either, because if, just like you said, Swan is totally going to slut shame her and like lecture her in the subway, and then at the end, he's like, here's some flowers, I didn't want them to go to waste, and they're going to walk off into the sunset.
Well, I think what you're saying is I don't understand Swan, and on that I'll agree with you. Her, I completely get. She's bored. She lives in the neighborhood with the orphans. She never sees any action. I mean, this is, yeah, what people do when they're bored. They create trouble. She causes a problem between these two gangs where there would have been none. The orphans were going to let these guys go through, and she makes the chicken sounds and heckles them because, yeah, she wants to see blood. She wants to see a fight. She likes the idea of men fighting over her, and that's just the sign of someone that needs to be entertained. And of course, she has an eye for Swan. You know, she wants his jacket. She starts that flirtation. She wants to see if she can get these guys to concede anything. And the fact that she stays in the storyline and they end up falling in love is just because of Hollywood cliche. And I'm not sure it would have played any better if it was the Fox. In fact, I might even be stranger if it was the little scrawny guy and not Michael Beck.
Well, no, I could always go with, she likes the sensitive guy, you know?
Yeah, that's what they were trying to do on the page. That's how it comes across, is that he, while still judgmental in the way that he's going to be in the subway, he also judged his own life. He was also just kind of over being in Coney Island.
Well, I do love, like, as the orphans are charging in on them, they make a Molotov cocktail. Is it Swan that, like, grabs her and he's like, oh, they are going to start running that train on her? But no, he just grabs her skirt to rip it to put that rag into that cocktail to throw it.
Yeah. And again, one bomb and these guys are done. The orphans, yes, are toast. It should not come as a surprise. In fact, the riffs are not even aware of who the orphans are. They're just told it's some low-level operatives that they don't have any dealings with who failed. The point is that now the Warriors are out of the Bronx. They're past Harlem. They're on the train platform that they need to be in. And it's really because of the cops that they get stymied up and broken up.
Yeah, and this was where it feels like Fox was going to be the main character, because Mercy goes with him. She's going to see him get thrown in front of a train by a cop as they face off.
This movie, when I was talking about Red Heat having better action, my problem is completely with the cutting. Maybe it's the cinematographer, maybe it's the budget. Maybe in this case, it's the fact that, what did the Fox say? I'm out of here. But when this whole thing goes down and they split into three groups, I'm following it. When Fox is wrestling with the cop and gets thrown in front of the train, it's not presented as a major event. And the way that it cuts and it jump cuts to now you're just seeing a subway go down the tunnel, I'm like, what I'm seeing is telling me he's dead, but this movie is not selling to me that one of the warriors just died and I should be sad about that.
That's because it's one of the stunt doubles. They didn't even have the actor to film the scene properly to give him wow. the kind of death that would be a salute. He had walked off at this point. So, yeah. Ironically, Thomas Waits has come around and he does do the reunion stuff, but his name is not in the credits. You will not even see Fox credited if you look at the cast list because he was so mad over this movie at the time. So some of that, it just couldn't be helped. It was the rewrite. And so I think you're right. You don't notice that one of them dies. But if you're confused about what's happening, my advice to any newbie watching this movie is not to try and look for character arcs or what's going on, but just to enjoy the environment, just to enjoy the city and the way that it moves, and certainly the gangs that they're going to encounter.
I'm only paying attention to names because I got to talk about this on Now Playing. When I watched this originally, I just go with the colors. Okay, there's the red vest. Those are the good guys for this movie. And then my favorite gang shows up. You know, the warriors are going to get split off into two groups, and they're going to have, half of them are going to have to face off against the Furies, the baseball gang that also paints their faces for some reason. Like, you've already got a gimmick. Why are you painting your faces? You're going the extra mile there. You got two things.
And one of them with the yellow face makes me think of Paul Stanley. There's one with a red and black face that's like Darth Maul.
Yeah, they're different colors. It's not even like they're the same colors. They're painting their face.
And you're on to Arnie because the costume designer admitted Kiss was really popular at this time and they just, she went with that. And I actually believe, I've tried to find this out through internet research. I'm not a sports guy, so I can't be sure about it. But I don't think people started doing that tailgating, paint your face stuff until this movie. I actually think it was the Baseball Furies that taught baseball fans how to be crazy fans. I think painting your face came out of the Warriors.
Did lightsaber fights with baseball bats also come out of the Warriors? Because they have some... This is actually a good fight here where they start going at each other with bats. There's a lot of repetitive blocking, but you get hit with a baseball bat, it's going to freaking hurt, and they really get some good knocks here. The Warriors are tough. They are a tough gang. They're not just a good guy gang. These guys, the way they're going to make it through the night is by being the biggest badasses around. They're going to have to fight these people. They can't just run the whole time, and they succeed. There's only four Warriors here, and they take out like a dozen Furies.
It's actually only six, but yeah, it feels like more.
It feels, yeah, I thought it was more than six. This action, it's not great. This looked like me and my brothers when we pretend baseball bats were lightsabers. But again, it's a fun scene. Like, I like this universe that they've built.
Yeah, it's better than when Ajax kicked the cop. That had a major jump cut that it distracted me. It was so poorly done. This is perhaps, honestly, the best fight in the movie is the Furies versus the Warriors.
Yeah, and again, I don't care about combat. My eyes glaze over whenever I'm watching an action movie and people are punching one another. I can't wait for that to end. I like the movement. What I love about this scene is that the camera is on dolly tracks and they're running right alongside these guys. These guys are running as hard as they can for half a mile and that camera is relentlessly staying on focus, which is not easy to do, and following them every step of the way. It's awesome.
Yeah, I did notice that. I always thought this was like a B midnight movie, a low production value type thing, but the editing, yeah, a lot of these shots look very, you know, A Hollywood grade.
Well, that's because I think Walter Hill and his cinematographer were just really interested in how to shoot at night. It was a big reason why they wanted to make this movie was how are we going to do this? I mean, the challenge, you know, they had to figure out where to hide the lights and plant things. I mean, they've got wide shots here and they ended up just kind of putting, the cameraman was like, I'm surprised no one ever asked me why there are just spotlights coming out of the trees, but it's because we had nowhere to hide the lights. And it ends up creating this really fantastic world. I don't consider it a comic book world, but it is not our world, and it really colors New York in a way that feels special. I love the way that this movie takes in New York and the way that we move through these neighborhoods, and yeah, I think everyone loves the Baseball Furies. They're just so over the top.
I like that they keep going through, because it's nighttime in New York, I can't really get a bead on where they are in geographically at any given time. But yeah, it is a lot of fun. I never questioned spotlights coming from the trees. I did question why there's a cameraman reflecting in the Griff's sunglasses, but I never thought about the spotlights.
I think they were at 96 Station, which means basically that they were like, what, Upper West Side, and then basically this is Central Park.
Is this Central Park? That's what I couldn't figure out.
That's what I assumed.
I don't think they actually shot it in Central Park, but I think that is, I mean, to move from Harlem to where they're at, yeah, that would be logically what I know about New York, more an approximate about where they're at this point. And they're trying to get down to Union Square. It was agreed upon early on that if we get split up, we'll meet up at the place where we can catch the train that'll take us all the way home. And so, yeah, you know that they got several city blocks to go, dozens of city blocks.
It was the Union Station that was throwing me, because Union Station's a ways away from Central Park. So
yeah, I think they got 60 city blocks to go.
Yeah.
What throws me is they beat the baseball Furies. They're strolling through the park and Ajax like, hey, there's a hot chick. I want to rape her. You guys go ahead. And this is his downfall.
This is as crazy a write-off character as Fox. This is just like...
Yeah, that's like, I kind of liked Ajax because he was always pushing back and he's going to go away at this point.
You are giving the complaint that everyone has given Walter Hill since the movie was released. They okay. love Ajax. And they don't like the way that he gets taken out by this. That he basically loses because this whole time he's been talking about you guys are fags and I want to get laid and maybe I'm going to lay some down when I get up there. That he's got a one-track mind and he's preoccupied by it. He's taken out by it too. Because he won't be a good soldier, because he won't listen to leadership, because he can't see an obvious ruse about a woman that has no business being in this park.
Yes.
I mean, it should be a real alarm that she's sitting there being like, come sit down by me. I mean, I don't know that I would think that the cops do this, but I would know something is wrong and this guy's just not smart and he's done in by it. And keep in mind, they are supposed to be whittling down the cast. Conchise, the Indian you talked about, he was supposed to be killed by the baseball Furies. He was going to be one of the ones running from them and gets a bat to the head and dies.
That would make sense to me, is that like each challenge takes out a warrior and makes it more and more desperate. And the problem with Ajax is they pull this same trick twice, because you've got Ajax here in the park where he's going to be taken out by his libido in a way that doesn't impact the plot. We don't think that Sting is related to the gang violence going on. It doesn't pose a danger for the other warriors. It does separate Swan from the other two guys because two decide to go back for Ajax and Swan's like, fuck him. But then the other group is also going to get seduced by a bunch of women trying to take them out, the Lizzies. It would have felt cleaner to me if you just had Ajax with the Lizzies, Ajax leading his small group while Swan leads his other group. You got the two contested leaders, each with a group. And if you want to kill Ajax because he wants to get laid, have a Lizzie stab him.
See, and I think that maybe the thing to do is if they were going to keep the Dingoes, the gay S&M gang, maybe the payback for Ajax would be that would be who kidnapped him. You know, he's so taunting about the other men's sexual orientation, that could have been a fun thing to play with as well. But I don't have a problem with it. I get that Ajax is the character that you both love and you hate. And yeah, it feels unfair that it winds up this way, that he ends up going down this way. And it feels just as another way as well. It was in the book, the only difference being it wasn't a cop. It was a woman that he actually tried to rape, and she had a rape whistle, and cops came and got him.
Yeah, I wasn't sure if it was just a citizen with a rape whistle or if she was undercover, but yeah, she was undercover. She pulls out the handcuffs him to the bench, and the cops show up.
I don't know what he does wrong. She's willing to sleep with him. He does get a little rough.
Yeah, he gets getting very rough, and she is saying, stop, you need consent.
Yeah, no, it was entrapment. I mean, she to go there and debate men and then to say, oh, no, is not playing by the rules, by my mind. That is a bad sting. That is unfair. But yes, the fact of the matter is he's like, you don't get it. I like it rough. And he's going to force himself upon her. That is where the line is crossed. And that is when she cuffs him. And that is when it is over for probably, yes, the most popular warrior character. By the way, I don't know that anyone recognizes her at this point, but that actress, the only Oscar winner in the entire cast, Mercedes Rule. She would go on to famously co-star in The Fisher King.
Oh, yeah. Good movie.
I don't remember her in it.
I remember her from that and a number of films around that time. Once you win the Oscar, you then do yes. other stuff.
Anytime they needed a loud New Yorker, she was the one in the early 90s. But yeah, you mentioned the Lizzies. Everyone's trying to get to Union Square. There is a bunch of them that get there early. They're like, what are we going to do? We have to wait for everyone else to arrive. And Swan's going to have to go there by walking. And the other guys are messing around in Central Park. So why not go off with these hot chicks that are sizing them up?
Hot chicks. Okay. Yeah, it's strange wool. I can see why they want to hook up. I do love that they have a female gang in this movie. And this feels dangerous. This feels like a bad idea. But, you know, you're a young, horny man. I guess you go along with it.
Yeah. And, you know, the Lizzies, the Lezzies, obviously.
That's okay. Yeah, because there is one shot when they go back to their hangout. Like, there's two that are, like, dancing, and I'm like, I don't think they're into guys.
No. They're like, where are your dudes? Chicks like you always have your dudes. I'm like, not these chicks. Nope.
Yeah, I wondered. But then when they're like, take your pick, and they start making out with them, I was confused. I didn't know exactly what was going on with this scene. I knew it was a trap, but I don't know if they were actually lesbians or if, because they said their guys all went to a meeting. So I thought they might have had guys and
in the Bronx, which means that they're the girls of the gangsters that were at the meeting that they're running from.
Exactly. So that's how I took it, is they did have guys and they were down there, you know, digging it with Cyrus.
Yeah, well, I mean, I think the subtext is pretty clear once you see them dancing and the switchblades come out. And yeah, they are like sirens from Greek myth that have lured these sailors to the rocks for their death. And the plan was to kill Vermin, who is the hairy-chested one, Terry Mikos, who would go on to be a TV news reporter. He would not stay in acting, but he can still be seen on screen. He was the one that, you know, is the first to make out with the girl on the couch. He was going to get his throat slit, but they liked him so much. They're like, we can't kill this guy. So they cut Rembrandt, the one that was like, I don't want to be here.
I liked Rembrandt.
He was the one that was like, we need to go. We need to not do this. The sensible one gets cut. And Conchise, who was supposed to be in the park getting killed by the baseball furies, runs through a door. I'm not even going to bother opening it. I'm just going to run through the wood.
It makes no sense, but I love that shot as he comes through the door. Like, it's a great one.
Yeah, it's a lot of fun. And again, to me, this is great action because it's not about like, wow, the adrenaline rush and this, you know, feeling what it would be like to be in a fight. It's because it's outlandish. It's over the top. It's making me laugh. It's surprising me.
But yeah, none of them do get killed, and they're going to actually get back together when Swan has to face off against the roller skating gang. What's that name?
They're the Punks. That was pretty lame.
Yeah.
Just the Punks? Huh. Well, and I love, like, as the Punks are trailing them, I wish they were all wearing roller skates.
I think I agree.
One is. Yeah. With their overalls and their striped long-sleeve polos.
You can't be a gang unless you're all in overalls. The Xanadu gang.
Yeah, there's nothing less punk than Oshkosh Bagosh.
But I love, like, they're like, let's go hide out in the boys' bathroom. And Mercy's like, I can't go in. There's the boys' bathroom.
You know what? That's the one fight I don't care about. I skip over it because I honestly have nothing to say. They didn't get a cool enough gang to make that seem very cool. The only thing that comes out of it is Swan gets a really good cut on his cheek at that point. He doesn't have those perfect features anymore. He's been scarred up.
It's always so distracting how bad that makeup is.
Yeah.
With that scar. You can see the putty on it.
It looks like a giant wart.
You guys are the ones to point that out. I didn't have a problem with it, but you guys and your effects.
Blu-ray does bad makeup no favors.
Yeah, that is true. Again, you guys are talking about a Blu-ray ultimate cut that is going to accentuate and clean up all the grain, too. I mean, that's one thing I love about 70s film is how much grain can be in a particular shot. That's not meant to be erased. That is part of the texture.
Even the theatrical cut I saw was high def, cleaned up, no grain.
Yeah, which is a shame. Yeah, I like that grain.
Yeah, it's a part of the look. I mean, I just feel like some movies, yeah, I've been horrified at watching some of these 70s movies re-released on Blu-ray and what they do to them.
But they do know they're in danger at this point. The Lizzies let them know that they have been maybe framed, blamed, whatever, for the death of Cyrus. So they're more aware of their surroundings, I think, at this point.
Sadly enough, it doesn't matter anymore. I mean, the fact is that they're at the depot where they need to be to go home. It would be another thing to realize that back in the Bronx. But now that they're at the train platform that they need to get on to go home with no stops, it's kind of like, yeah, well, those other gangs really, they'll have to follow our dust. And it's worth pointing out, there is the Rogues. They are circling around. They've got a car, unlike some of these other gangs, and is trying to find them. So we kind of know that it's getting home to Coney Island is not going to be the end of this. But yes, Swan comes out of the tunnel with Mercy. He's still with her and they're working whatever that is out. They've made out and now she's trying to help him and he's so bad to her. What's so annoying about it is that he's so dismissive of every single thing that she does and at the end decides he's going to go with her anyway. It just makes me hate him.
Yeah, I didn't understand his reason why. If there was something there, it doesn't seem like a good romance. And maybe he's trying to be, you know, gang, you know, just brutal and kind of ugly in that regard. But yeah, his whole treatment of her is
deplorable.
Yeah, and the scene where they're like across from the people who are going to prom or something on the train, and they're afraid of the gang members, but I don't know what I'm supposed to get there. Is Mercy supposed to be thinking that's the life she wanted and should have?
Come on, Arnie. You get it. It's obvious. It's in giant neon colors. She's self-conscious. Exactly. These are the people that live the life I'll never have.
And so when he hands her the flowers, he's handing her second-rate scraps of the life she'll never have.
Well, he's recognizing that she wants something more.
Yeah, exactly.
She doesn't want to be this slut with a mattress on her back.
Yeah, that they're both starting to talk about. I mean, what's interesting about the moment, even corny though it may be, is that he gets home and realizes, why are we fighting so hard for this? This is not that great. How do you keep them on the farm after they've seen the big city? It's why do we seclude ourselves to this boardwalk? I think that at any point in time that someone steps away from their home and they have that moment, that's a powerful revelation, one that I could relate to. And he's thinking about traveling now and she's inviting herself along and he's still being awful by saying, well, you don't know anything about travel.
And what is shocking to me, knowing warriors come out to play, like, I can't believe this happens at the end of the film. I always figured that'd be like in the middle.
Yeah.
Like, no, this is at the very end.
And the clinking of the bottles, it actually gives a menace to this character that he's never had before. I mean, it's silly to see him with the things on his fingers, but by the same token, that rhythmic thumping, it does make it a little ominous.
And he gets more and more manic as he says the line like three times and higher pitched and just crazier and crazier.
I gotta think he was meant to say it once and they're like, all right, just do a whole bunch of takes and then just use them all.
You've got it, Arnie. You've nailed the editor. He only did it once or twice and the editor extended it. And I can't not watch this scene and laugh. People tell me it's ominous, but I think it is hysterical.
Oh, it's such a great scene.
First of all, the way that it's set up, you just hear the clanking. You don't even know what that is. They're under the boardwalk. They're trying to find these weapons. You know it's going to be some kind of face-off. I'm not really worried for them because if they could take the Baseball Furies, they can take the Rogues.
But the Rogues have a gun, so...
Well, that comes into play later. But right now, they have beer bottles on their finger, and that's what the clanking is. And then him, yeah, just going for it with, like, each time he says it, louder and louder and louder. Nobody in their right mind would have included some of those takes. And I just love that it's in there. It's hysterical.
It's an improvised line from what I've read. Like, this wasn't in the script.
No, it's not in the script. I have read the script, and basically they realized they needed a taunt, and David Patrick Kelly said, give me 5 minutes, and...
That's what he comes up with, is come out and play?
Yeah, pretty much. Yeah, he had a neighbor that used to taunt him in Manhattan. He lived in a Manhattan apartment back when you didn't want to do that kind of thing and when rents were cheap. And he would just knock, I guess, on his door and be like, David, David. And he was like, yeah, that guy's a real creep. I'm going to do him for this movie.
That took him 5 minutes to come up with?
Yep. Spontaneous inspiration. He found the bottles by walking around the boardwalk and said, all right, I'm putting them on my fingers. This is what we're doing. I mean, who knows? There are probably a lot of other things that people tried that just didn't make the movie that they're like, yeah, that's not working. But this was just a stroke of genius. And again, yeah, it has become a defining thing of this movie. But when I first saw it, I did not know it was coming. And I don't even think I heard the rest of the dialogue in this movie because I would not stop laughing. It was just entertaining me so much. But it's a Western at this point. They're on their own home turf. They're in the daylight, which is when they're supposed to have been leaving, but they ended up changing that in post. And now they're on the sand facing off against a gang with a gun. Are you really worried? I'm like, yeah, maybe he can get one of them, but the others should be able to take them out.
That's why it would be good if you'd killed one at each stop and it was just him. Yes. Then I'd actually believe maybe he'll die. Maybe this is the story of his last night. And instead, when it's all of them against all of them and he's like one-on-one, yeah, it's really not a good action scene. And when Luther takes a shot, he's going to hit somebody. I don't know where that bullet went. Somehow it seemed to go through Mercy magic and not bullet. Hurt her.
Shot Kennedy. I don't know where it went, but it did not go where it was pointed.
Yeah, I always thought this was kind of anticlimactic. Swan throws that switchblade, hits his hand, whatever. I'm just glad the riffs show up again.
There you go. I don't even remember the Warriors doing anything. What I remember is riffs. Yeah, right. I mean, that's what you're here to see. It's entertaining because somewhere down the line, some tattooed Irishman said, oh, yeah, I saw the killer, too. The Warriors are validated as being good guys.
The best.
Yeah, really didn't cause any problems.
Yeah, I love Swan. The best. I don't know, Swan, but you're good.
Yeah, particularly if you look at Megaforce or Xanadu.
Yeah, and especially since you had have the riffs come and save your ass.
Yeah, but I don't mind that because, again, it's not playing by the traditional rules of I need to see these guys win. In some weird way, I feel like they aren't willing to fight anymore. I feel like the character, anyway, Swan, now when he goes walking away on the beach, I think that he may never come back. He's with his girl now. He doesn't need to be at Coney Island. He doesn't believe in what he used to believe. And I think that would come through more if it had been played by the Fox and we had gotten some of that original dialogue. It's definitely in the book. And the book ends, if you want to talk anticlimactic, it ends with the kid just coming home and seeing his half-brother sleeping with his half-sister in a bed and going and taking a nap. And that is the end of the story.
Yeah, I would get that he's walking away from Coney Island more if he wasn't walking away with his gang. But they're all going away together.
Yeah, I do feel like something that probably should have happened was whittling them down. But that said, I'm with Walter Hill. I like all these guys. I wouldn't want to see them dead. I like that it's a happy ending for just about everyone except Ajax, who was an asshole. So if he spends a night in the cooler, it probably serves him right.
On my second viewing for this review, it hit me. He's the safest of all of them. Nobody's going to kill him in prison, so maybe they all should get arrested.
I don't know. Those cops arrested a lot of gang members when they busted up that meeting.
Yeah, I don't know that you're safe in prison, and I wouldn't presume that the people you'd run in your jail cell were going to be nice to you, but
that's a whole other movie.
Who knows? Maybe he got some action finally. I don't know.
Oh.
You're saying he turned faggot?
Maybe. He did in his next film. The Cruising was the next time James Remar appeared on camera, and that is probably what the Dingo Gay Gang was going to be.
Well, Jacob Stewart, do you recommend going out and playing with the Warriors? Jacob.
There are things that, if this was a lesser film, would really bug me, like the lack of characterization or arcs for some of these characters. Yeah, you could maybe force something in there with Swan that he's walking away from the gang life or with Mercy. It's not really there. And could you apply the Odyssey or some kind of Greek myth to their journey? Maybe. But it's a fun enough movie that I don't need to do that. Yeah, sometimes I like to read that stuff into a film and it enhances it. This, you don't need to enhance. It's already great. Time. It's a great song. It's a great dance. with the colorful gangs, with the music, just the storyline, like the personalities with the DJ, with Cyrus. This has got so much style and so much fun to it. I don't necessarily need those things that I would need from a deeper film. Yeah, this ending is anticlimactic. I don't really care. I've had a great time. I'm ready to go take a stroll on the beach in Coney Island too. It's strong recommend for the Warriors.
Stuart.
I mean, obviously I picked it. I love the movie. What I'm reminded of time and time again when I come back to it is how well it just shows off New York in the 70s and just a guy movie. You know, just there's something about gangs and guys getting together that it just really celebrates that spirit here. I think it's a lot of fun. But I actually will advocate. I do feel like in some weird way, in its simplistic fable-like way, it does kind of advocate the way that I see America. We're all tribes. We all could be unified and be a whole lot better. But at the end of the day, it is about your turf. And I do think that that is why this movie is probably primed to be remade. I will talk about that in a minute, but I don't think that they could make a version that I would love any more than The Warriors. This one is one of my absolute favorites.
This is a pretty good movie, and so I didn't want to spend the review harping on its downsides, but I'm going to give it a recommend, but it's a far more tempered recommend than either of you have given. For me, the lack of characterization would be fine if it made up for it in action, but the action scenes are not well directed, and both times I watched it, I found something. I was really into it for the first hour, and then when they got to the Lizzies both times, I realized I just didn't care anymore. And I was finally brought back into it both times with Warriors, come out and play. That's when I'm ready for the end. And then I don't think the end is done very well. I love this film's style. I love this film's attitude. I love this film's music. There's so much I do love about this film, but there's also a lot of things I don't like the relationship, the fuzzy character arcs, the muddled endings, and the poor action. But it's good. I don't think it is an untouchable masterpiece that could not be made better, but it's good.
Some of these things are about when you discover the movie, too. I feel like you're seeing this through the eyes of a cynical adult that's like, I want it to compare with action movies that I get nowadays.
I want it to compare with Red Heat.
Yeah.
Ooh.
Yeah.
It's far better than Red Heat.
Yeah, well, I mean, it's very different than Red Heat. I mean, again, I respond to the energy of this movie. It's really about that. The movement of the camera, the guy chemistry, just it's about what it creates, and I get an adrenaline high from it. I mean, I do feel like that will be hard to duplicate, even if they spend a bazillion dollars and do incredible budget and maybe go back and do the original book correctly and make it more of a drama with excellent acting. I mean, you could take lots of different approaches, but I don't know that any of them will nail the energy.
And I never got adrenalized during this, and that's what I wanted. I wanted to feel that adrenaline, and it just never got it to me, and I blame the staging of the action.
Well, for many years, someone that is very experienced in making action movies you love was going to make this project, and then he killed himself.
Oh, right. I forgot about that.
Tony Scott was going to bring it to L.A. They were going to remake it as an L.A. movie and use all the L.A. gangs, and I imagine it would be a lot like Colors if you ever saw that Dennis Hopper movie.
Yeah.
But that did not come to fruition. And yeah, you mentioned Neville Dean and Taylor. They briefly had it. The ones that own it now are the Russo brothers, the ones that have done the Captain America movies. And they want to do it on TV, I think, as a serialized show. I think instead of just following them in one night, we would see the ongoing adventures about all of these gang members, and we would learn all their backstories and would probably straddle the difference between the social realism of the book and the comic book action of this film.
I don't know that I want that. I don't know that I want this to be deep characters and basically a Sopranos of street gangs that wear funny outfits.
Yeah, I don't know if I want 10, 13, 22 episodes of that. I could go for the deep characterization. I just want it in film form.
Yeah, I just think one of this film's strengths is that it was 90 minutes long. And if you're going to be telling me that this isn't about one night, this isn't a chase film, it's going to become basically, the reason I said Sopranos is, yeah, it's a whole bunch of different gangs and gang warfare and gang politics. That does not sound like something I would enjoy, and it does not seem true to the spirit of this film.
Yeah, it would be different, but, you know, I have been surprised by serialized television concepts that I never thought could be adapted from movies like Bates Motel. I've been more or less entertained with and stayed with, so I could see it working, but yeah, it's not a surefire hit. I could see also not feeling like it captured what I love. It won't. It will not capture what I love about this movie, which is not to say that it can't be something that I would enjoy, and yeah, I'll tune in whenever it comes out. Should it make it on the air, I definitely will give the pilot a try, and we'll see from there. And as far as everything else, yeah, I don't own the toys. I know that there's a board game coming. I know that there's action figures. I've never played the video game. Apparently, I did watch a lot of the module, and you can have extended adventures. It actually begins with gang initiation, and then the climax is the plot of this movie. But much of the game is spent in various neighborhoods. Basically, every neighborhood where you see one of these gangs, you're supposed to rip off a jewelry store or rob a stereo from a car.
Yeah, that does sound like Grand Theft Auto. It's just the technology back then wasn't the greatest for that kind of stuff, as I remember. And they did get a lot of the cast back. I think that was one of the big gets for this, as so many of the original actors reprised their roles.
Most of the ones did come back. There are some that have distanced themselves. Cowboy has gone on to do theater in London and just doesn't promote this movie. And Snow actually became a cop and doesn't talk about this movie at all. But everyone else that is alive comes back and does the conventions or the screenings. You can go to YouTube and see very recently that you can see, if you've been wondering how these guys look now, they put on the jackets, they get in the subway car, they ride to Coney Island. You can see a then and now comparison between the cast members of the Warriors as they were in 1978 when they filmed this and as they were in 2015. It's a pretty stark contrast. I'm just going to say that.
Yeah, that sounds really depressing, so I don't think I'll watch that.
It was mildly depressing, and yet I'd like to see that these guys, who really didn't go on to have major careers, get some love. It's nice to know that a movie that had so much impact on people, that people can give back to them. So it was nice in that way, but yeah, a little embarrassing as well.
Were they all shirtless?
No, they just were, well, yeah, but they were wearing their vests. They don't take off their colors.
They have their dad bods now, so yeah, they have to wear a shirt.
Yeah, it's just, times are different. You know, they were talking about the trouble they were having taking the stairs. Very different from jumping the turnstiles, you know? It's like, oh, which I think they were playing up to the camera, too. I mean, don't get me wrong. They know very well that they're not the young men they used to be, and I think we're okay with it. There wasn't a whole lot of vanity.
And with that, that wraps up our review of The Warriors. I'm so glad, Stuart, you got a chance to discuss this film and that this is going to give us an opportunity to do just that, to review some one-off films we wouldn't get a chance to that hopefully will tie in some way like our Easter egg shows did to something we're doing, but in some cases may just be something we've been wanting to discuss. That said, the next film we're going to be doing in just a couple months is one we had a donor go just so generous and make the $500 pledge to pick a movie for us to do. That's going to be our next one. It's a little independent film called Coherence, starring Nicholas Brendon.
I've seen it. It's pretty good, as I recall. I imagine they're asking us to review it because it's a movie that you're not sure what you watched after you've seen it. Coherence is used ironically as a title. I'm not sure if it did cohere, but we'll figure that out and talk about it next time we do one of these shows.
And then after that, we're going to be picking some movies. We're open to suggestions and what you want to hear. Thank you so much for your continued monthly support of our show. You have no idea how important it is to us and how much it means to us. And we hope that these bonus shows are an adequate thank you to express the gratitude we feel. And Stuart Jacob, thank you for joining me.
You bet.
So you hear me, babies? Good. Real good. Adios.
Why'd you do it? Why'd you waste Cyrus? No reason. I just like doing things like that.
Thank you to all the listeners who have backed us through our Podbean crowdfunding campaign, and we hope you've enjoyed this special bonus movie review podcast.
How come you're so happy about this? I'm having a good time.
Now Playing relies on support from listeners like you to keep going. So thanks to you all.
That is a miracle. And miracles is the way things ought to be.
Now that you've heard this review, head to the Now Playing Podcast forums and share your thoughts on this movie. The link to our forums is at nowplayingpodcast.com.
Stay tuned, boppers.
This podcast was not prepared, approved, or licensed by any entity that created or produced the well-known film, The Warriors. Now Playing is an independent movie review podcast with no affiliation with any company involved in the publishing, creating, or distribution of that film, soundtrack, or video game.
Yeah, real simple. Except that every cop in this city's looking to bust our heads.
The opinions expressed on Now Playing are those of the individual hosts and may not reflect the opinion of Venganza Media Incorporated.
This is what we fought all night to get back to.
Now Playing is a Venganza Media production, copyright 2017, all rights reserved, and no part of this show may be reproduced, repurposed, or redistributed without the written permission of Venganza Media Incorporated.
Yeah, that's right, warriors. Just keep walking. Real tough mothers, ain't you?
You still looking for us?
We found what we're looking for. You warriors are good. Real good.
The best.
I wonder if my favorite movie of his is actually Brewster's Millions.
You know, she is a familiar face. I actually know who she is. One Day at a Time, that wacky sitcom with Monroe.
Who was she in One Day at a Time? I mean, I know that show real well.
She's one of the leads.
Yeah.
You're thinking Close for Comfort, Not One Day at a Time.
Huh?
You're thinking Too Close for Comfort, Not One Day at a Time. One Day at a Time was Valerie Bertinelli.
Oh, God. See, I always confuse those two.
Which is the one with J.J. Bullock?
Yeah, it's the one with Monroe.
That's Too Close for Comfort.
Oh, okay. Well, there you go.
That's
okay,
the one
I'll
it is.
The problem with Ajax is they pull the same trick.
If you've seen Taxi Driver on Blu-ray, they kept that grain. There is so much grain in that film. It's great.
Oh, good. Well, I saw Jaws, and I will never watch that on Blu-ray again.
It's gorgeous on Blu-ray.
It's terrible.
Love Jaws on Blu-ray.
It's terrible.
I'm not a grain fan. I like it smooth.
Because somewhere down the line, some tattooed Irishman like said, "Oh yeah, I saw The Killer too." And now
is that your Irish accent?
I mean, he doesn't speak, so I'm just gonna. That's my Irish tattooed voice.
The Leprechaun from Lucky Charms.
If you need me for the sequel, just let me know, Hollywood. Yeah, it was the fucking little one.
It's not getting better.
Anyway, the point is,